he calculated that if you have an electric charge and a magnetic charge, then the Coulomb field of these two things contains an extra angular momentum, which is proportional to the electric charge times the magnetic charge. Then, as you know, Dirac came along and said, why not?
Yeah, why did they take so long? I mean, 1904 and Maxwell was much earlier. Like, what took so long?
Oh, why did it take so long?
Either way, you can ask the question.
Well, Maxwell probably didn't believe in magnetic charges, did he?
But did Thomson?
Mm-hmm. Enough to do the calculation.
So we found the point.
This was a pretty unsteady model for you, right?
Thomson,
right?
Back when experimentalists could do theory calculations. So Dirac came along and said, what about if we, how do you do this in quantum mechanics? So if you have a magnetic charge, Dirac said, you can write down a gauge potential, but it has a singularity in it. But that singularity is just a gauge artifact, so it shouldn't be observable. So how do you check if it's observable? Well, he said you could do an Aronov-Bohm experiment. He didn't say it that way, because Aronov wasn't born yet, and Bohm was in high school, probably. You take a charge, take it around this sort of fake solenoid, and measure the flux through here, through a Aronov-Bohm. And what you'll see is you get an extra phase as you go around here. And the phase is Q times G. And so, if Q times G is N over 2, then that phase is 1, and so it's unobservable. And also, you will remember that J.J. Thomson already told us that this was the angular momentum.
The phase is pi, right?
Yeah. If it's N over 2, then the phase is a multiple of pi. So this is an angular momentum, and angular momentum is quantized in units of N over 2. So we could have, J.J. Thomson, if he'd known about quantum mechanics, could have predicted charge quantization. Now, later on, much older Dirac came back to think about monopoles yet again. And what he wanted to know is, how do you write down a field theory for photons interacting with electric and magnetic charges? And what he came up with was that you need to add some extra piece to the field strength, because the Bianchi identity is no longer satisfied if you have magnetic charges. And this extra piece in the field strength, he came up with this formula that involves the magnetic current, and N is some vector that is like some remnant of the Dirac string direction. And you can see that this is some horribly non-local thing. And after that, people started saying, when you have magnetic charges and electric charges, everything's mutually non-local. You've heard that, people say that, right? So that was the origin of mutually non-local. So that made everything look very mysterious, and people still think it's mysterious. We're going to see it's not mysterious. Okay, after that, Schwinger said, you think monopoles are hard, I can give you monopoles that also have electric charges. So we have both Q and G. Then the Dirac charge quantization gets generalized to this more complicated thing, where we have dion 1 and dion 2, which each have electric and magnetic charges. It's still quantized. Then next, big development was Zwanziger. So Zwanziger figured out how to write down a Lagrangian that was local, that had couplings to electric and magnetic currents. Oops. So we have two gauge potentials to do this. One couples to the electric current, and the second one, B, couples to the magnetic current. Those are local couplings. The price is that the Lagrangian is not manifestly Lorentz invariant, because he needs to have, again, a four vector hanging around to make things work. This is, again, some kind of remnant of the Dirac string. And the reason that you need it is that you still only want to have two propagating degrees of freedom, photons.
Is n a function position, or is n just a
vector? N is just a constant vector.
But is there a complete equivalence, like if I boost over this, like n would change, right? And
So observables will be n independent,
n independent
if you do your calculation correctly. That's the claim. But you need this n in here so that there are only two propagating degrees of freedom. The photon still only has two polarizations, even though you've described it by two four vectors. So with the combination of two gauge invariances and the kinetic matrix acting as a projector when momentum's on shell, you
so
project
n,
down to
n,
two.
N anchors on the bilinears of fields, that's why there is a chance that it doesn't have the interactions.
Mm-hmm. So, but not so many calculations have been done using this formalism.
Is it two gauge invariances, or is it something where we're working in a gauge, an independent gauge for A and B?
There's two gauge invariances, and then you can do gauge fixing. Yeah.
But if you try to merge it with gravity, then there will be a problem, right? Because you have a constant vector which would revive some gravity when you use a freedom, right?
So Sen and Schwartz independently discovered this thing again. Where it's equivalent to this with n being a time-like vector. And I believe in their paper they said they could do this thing also with gravity. In fact, their motivation was to find self-dual Lagrangians, so they found a self-dual Lagrangian for gravity as well.
Your stress energy is going to be n-independent. You said physical things are n-independent.
Observables better be n-independent, otherwise we're in trouble.
Very naively, if I include gravity, there will be a vertex that is graviton A and B, and it's n-independent.
Not if it couples to the stress energy, and the stress energy doesn't depend on it.
There will be a vertex, right, that can depend. The question is whether there are any interactions would in the end depend on M, right? Because if they do, then there is a chance that the end will propagate.
Amplitudes will be independent, but observables are not going to be independent.
At tree level or loop level?
At any level. So it's subtle because amplitudes will be independent. We'll see a reflection of that later on. Sure. Okay, the next development was due to Witten. He pointed out that if we include a theta term in our Lagrangian that couples F to F dual, then when we measure the electric charge of a dion, it's not what we thought it was. We thought if we put into the Lagrangian the charge was Q. When we measure the charge, we get electric charge plus magnetic charge times theta over 2 pi, which is kind of bizarre. But if you check it on explicit solutions of dions that you can get from Tofte-Malikov Polyakov generalizations, it actually is true. Which leads us to our next development.
Can it not be the other way around? You have monopoles that have a charge. But, I mean, does it mean that the electron, if there is a theta term for E and M, it would have a magnetic monopole charge?
No. It only works one way.
Yeah, so but you wrote charge, right?
The extra charge is proportional to the magnetic charge in the Lagrangian.
It's just a small correction to the charge.
Yeah. So if you have a magnetic charge, then there's a correction to your electric charge.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I got confused. Okay, that's fine, yes.
So Tofte-Malikov finally showed us how to construct monopoles by breaking an SUN gauge group down to U1. And they were topologically stable. So after this point, no one could laugh at you for talking about monopoles. Before that, people were free to laugh at you. And
well, after they still are free people. It's harder as well.
So there were many attempts before this to prove that monopoles couldn't exist by some consistency condition, including one by Weinberg, who proved that they shouldn't exist by some consistency condition.
He actually took that to paper form, and there was a
yeah in his famous paper where he derives gravity and electromagnetism.
The one you're talking about.
There he proves that monopole electron scattering amplitudes are not Lorentz invariant, so therefore monopoles can't exist. Okay, we'll zoom up to the 90s. Seiberg and Witten looked at an n equals 2 supersymmetric gauge theory broken down to U1. So it obviously has Tuft-Polyakov monopoles. Those monopoles have zero-mode solutions of the adjoint gauginos around them, which extends them into a full supersymmetric multiplet. So there are massless, there are fermionic monopoles in this theory. And then in the low-energy effective theory, in the leading derivative expansion, they were able to solve the theory. So over the moduli space, there's a moduli space that's a BEV of the adjoint scalar. The low-energy effective theory is completely described by an elliptic curve, which is equivalent to a torus. As you move along the moduli space, at certain points, one of the cycles of the torus degenerates. So this is this inner cycle shrinking to zero. At that point, there's a massless monopole. And over here, there's a massless dyon. And what this funny curve is plotting is the strength of the U1 gauge coupling. So when the monopole becomes massless, the U1 gauge coupling diverges at that point.
So now you've got the crappiest picture of all the ones you've shown.
Pardon?
Looks like he's at Jonestown, kind of.
He's at Tossie. He's at Tossie getting the younger generation to drink the Kool-Aid. And going a little bit further, with some perturbations, you can take the Seiberg-Witten theory, like add an extra flavor with a mass term, and then you can move these points around. So you can move the point where the monopole and the dyon become massless, move them up towards each other, put them on top of each other, so you have simultaneously a massless dyon and a massless monopole. And then you have mutually non-local stuff. And so the conjecture is that this is some theory, some CFT with massless electric and magnetic charges, which therefore has no Lagrangian description. The evidence being that no one's thought of the Lagrangian to write down for it. Okay, so that's monopoles. Now let's do duality. So back to the time of Maxwell, people knew that you could take E to B and B to minus E. And if you didn't have any charges around, that would be a symmetry, or if you had both electric and magnetic charges.
Before we leave the last topic, the thrust of your tone is that you're going to fix that, and you're going to tell us what Lagrangian is for a massless.
I'm going to tell you how you can write down a Lagrangian with both electric and magnetic charges. But this theory is presumably still strongly coupled, so whether that describes that theory, you'd have to do a lattice calculation, which I'm not going to do for you today. But an exercise left to the audience. Now, when we do quantum U1 theories, because we have this theta term, we have an extra symmetry because this is a periodic variable. We can shift theta by 2 pi. So that has to be a symmetry of the path integral. And because of this, it turns out to be convenient to write all our theories in terms of a holomorphic gauge coupling. So this is holomorphically normalized because the gauge coupling is appearing here. So we can combine these terms and write a holomorphic gauge coupling where the real part is theta and the imaginary part is 1 over alpha. And then we can see what string theorists call S-duality in a simple way. If we take a free electromagnetism with an arbitrary alpha and theta, the Lagrangian we just saw is equivalent to this. If we square this and take the imaginary part, we get out the ordinary kinetic term and the theta term. Now, usually you like to do your path integral over a gauge potential because it imposes the Bianchi identity for you. But alternatively, you could do your path integral over F and introduce a Lagrange multiplier to do impose Bianchi for you. And then since this action is quadratic in F, you could do that Gaussian integral. And then you'll get some different Lagrangian that depends on B. The Lagrangian you get is this, where this new field strength is the field strength made out of B as if it was a gauge field. So this is S duality in the free case, where everything can be done explicitly. There's a non-local relation between this gauge field and the gauge field that goes into here. And the other thing that happened was that tau went to -1/tau. So at least in the free theory, that's certainly a dual description of the same physics. And taking our two, our S duality and our periodic shift in theta, we can come up with a whole set of SL2Z transformations. So S takes tau to -1/tau. T takes tau to tau plus 1. That's shifting theta by 2 pi. And then we can do these in any order back and forth. And the most general thing you can come up with is transforms the holomorphic coupling like this by some Mobius transformation, where A, B, C, and D are integers, and AD minus BC equals 1 is what makes it SL. And under this, when the coupling transforms like this, the magnetic and electric currents get mixed up as well with these same integer coefficients. So this is supposed to be duality. It's not a symmetry necessarily of the theory. It just gives you another description in a different language of the same physics, possibly at different couplings. Everyone happy with it? SL2Z?
SL2Z.
It took me 10 years to learn to say Z.
Can I go back? I have a confusion. You wrote that, so in the case of the theta term, what happens to the quantization condition? How is it still satisfied for charges?
The quantization condition is invariant under SL2Z.
No. Going back a few slides, forget about going up to ordinary U1, when you were talking about this one. So here, if I have a monopole and a charge, then naively the quantization condition, given what you write there, is not satisfied. There is an additional term that goes like the g squared theta.
So if I shift theta by 2 pi, then I've changed my charge by some unit of g, and that is an SL2Z transformation. That reflects that mixing up of electric and magnetic currents.
Quantization condition is for small q and small g, right?
Let's look at this. This thing.
So this is what I'm.
This is invariant under an SL2Z transformation.
I see, but then that means that the electron, for example, becomes a dion in that picture.
For example, it could.
Because if I just substitute naively, have a.
If I have an electron in a monopole and do an SL2Z,
yes, exactly.
I'll get some other things with other charges. But when I calculate this, I'll get the same n/2 that I got originally. It's the SL2Z invariant. And the magic is because AD minus BC equals 1. So this will come with an AD minus BC multiplying it. We'll see another example of that in a few minutes. OK, so if we had a theory that had SL2Z duality, then we can, here's the entire holomorphic coupling plane. And what you can see is that if you take this sort of rectangle here with the curved bottom, this piece under SL2Z can be mapped to cover the rest of the plane. So this entire plane of gauge couplings and thetas is equivalent to just some point in here. And if we had a weakly coupled theory like QED with an electron, then we're sitting up here at small e. Then we've shaded that area red. So under SL2Z, that gets mapped to these other red regions. So in that case, all these red regions are weakly coupled theories since they're dual to this weakly coupled theory. So down here at strong coupling, we can have a weakly coupled theory.
And what is the width of this band?
Well, that's the 2 pi shift.
It's 1 on the
pi. Well, it's theta over 2 pi. Yeah. So for the case of electron, it makes sense, because if we have an electric charge that's weakly coupled, we do an SL2Z, make it a monopole. We have a monopole in a theory where the electric coupling is large, but the monopole couples with 1 over the electric coupling. So it actually couples weakly. So the theory with a weakly coupled electron here is dual to a theory with a monopole here, but with a large alpha, but it's the electric alpha that's large. So if you understand that, then we can skip to the end of the talk. Otherwise, I'll show you some examples of how that works. So let's... The most famous example that's thought to have a SL2Z duality is n equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills. So if we go out in the moduli space and break down to a U1, at weak coupling, we'll have some charged gauge bosons like Ws that have masses of the gauge coupling times the BeV. And we'll have some Tuf-Polyakov monopoles, and their zero modes will make up a whole n equals 4 vector multiplet, just like this vector multiplet. We do an SL2Z transformation, we can change this electrically charged gauge boson to a magnetically charged thing. And since it should be a monopole, if there's really an SL2Z duality, then its mass will be 4 pi over E dual times the BeV, just like this was 4 pi over E, this monopole. The monopole will be mapped to some electric thing. And then its mass, if there's an SL2Z duality, will be the dual electric coupling times the BeV. But because SL2Z equates 4 pi over E dual to E, since we took E dual is proportional to 1 over E, this mass and this mass are the same. So the spectrum is invariant. And what you see is, in this example, where I've chosen a hierarchy in the masses to get a weakly coupled theory. This takes a weakly coupled theory to a weakly coupled theory. So it's not mysterious like Seiberg duality or ADS-CFT. There you have a strongly coupled description and a weakly coupled description, and they describe the same thing. Here you have a weakly coupled description and a weakly coupled description that describe the same thing. So it's sort of just a choice of basis. And if we'd made these guys closer in mass, then we'd have some strongly coupled theory. But then these guys would have been close in mass, and we'd have a strongly coupled theory. So we can't arrange to get a strong weak duality like Seiberg duality. So just from that, yep?
So n equals 4 super Yang-Mills is a CFT event. So what do you mean by the change of coupling?
Like,
there's no change.
I've broken the conformal symmetry by going out on the moduli space to break it to U1 so that I could talk about SL2Z. So we're not going to use any supersymmetry, so we'll have n equals 0. And we'll just work in some low energy effective theory. So there may be some monopoles or something complicated up here. There's some light stuff in the theory, for example, a dion, let's say. And under SL2Z, we can map that to something that just has electric charge. But say this is an electron, for example. The electron mass isn't set by the gauge coupling. It's an independent parameter. So under SL2Z, the mass has to be invariant. So again, the spectrum is invariant even without supersymmetry. And again, we have to have a weak-weak duality. Even though at certain times, in certain expressions, it'll look like there's some secret strong interaction. So that's the end of the introduction slash motivation. Motivation is we're going to try to do calculations and verify this naive, simple picture. Okay, so first up, we'll calculate anomalies with dions going around the loop. So one way we could do that is to take this Wanziger Lagrangian. It has a local electric coupling and a local magnetic coupling. So there'd be graphs with A, B, B. And we'd add up those graphs, and that would be the anomaly. So that would be the easy way to do it. But we're going to do it the fancy way to anticipate further calculations.
What current is being inserted?
The axial current for the axial anomaly.
What are the lines?
This is some fermion that has charge Q and magnetic charge G.
So how do you turn, so the vertices you read out from this thing?
Yeah.
So there's some formula for J and K in terms of fermion.
Well, just psi bar gamma mu psi.
Okay.
Psi bar gamma mu psi with a G in front of it, and the other one has
a
Q.
So the same, just vanilla current, and it's vanilla fermion, right?
Vanilla fermion that has electric and magnetic charges. So to be completely general, we want to include holomorphic couplings, and so we can include theta. So there's a slight generalization of Zwanziger's Lagrangian. What that tells us is that since we know how, oh, I didn't show you how F transforms yet. Oh, that's a mistake. When I show you how F transforms, that will tell us how the gauge potentials transform under SL2Z. And this is the same C and D that we saw in the SL2Z. So here, the slides are reversed. Here I tell you how F transforms. So we know, here is the Maxwell equations for both with electric and magnetic currents. So what do we see? We see that the real part here will pick up a current plus a theta over 2 pi times the magnetic current. That's the Witten effect that we know about. And then the imaginary part is just what you expect from the, it's got d mu of f dual, and it has an inverse coupling enhancement compared to the electric current. So under SL2Z, we know how the currents transform. And so that tells us how the field strength should transform so that we get the Maxwell equation to transform properly. In a SL2Z transform basis, the Maxwell equation should just be putting primes on everything, because who told us that we were in any special basis? There's no special basis. So that means this field strength combination has to transform like this. And therefore, so that's just from the field equations. And then in the Zwanziger formalism, that also tells us how the gauge potentials transform. Now, the trick is to do the slick way of the calculation is to take our dion, do an SL2Z transformation that transforms it to something with only electric charge. You can do that. This charge has to be the greatest common denominator of these charges. So you just pick C is G over Q prime and D is Q over Q prime, and you have to enforce the SL2Z condition. So then this calculation is easy. You do it in the basis where this just has an electric charge, and we've done that calculation on our homeworks in quantum field theory second semester. So we just copy that. And then we want to write this in terms of something that we know how to transform simply under SL2Z. Since we're using holomorphic normalizations for the field strengths, we know that this combination transforms simply. And this expression is equal to that. Then we just map back to the original Dion basis.
So the axial current is not transformed, the same variable.
Yeah. So we map back, and then with a little bit of massaging, just expanding things out and using what C and D were to get to map it to Q prime in the first place, we find this expression. So
just going back to that previous question. So the state of the axial current is a variant means that you know how the duality acts on the fermions. So what's the transformation rule?
Well, the duality acts on the U1 gauge field, the U1 gauge coupling,
yeah,
and the charges slash currents. But the
so
gauge
the
field, currents.
So the fields don't do anything. They just sit
yeah
there and the Q plus 4 pi over Q shuffles amongst itself.
I mean, the axial current is a current of an independent symmetry that has nothing to do with gauge.
I was thinking that if you were to get the currents to transform, you had to have the fermions transform. Your transformation would make it exactly what you want, but you're just having it. You're imagining the parameters of Lagrangian and the charge.
I mean, right now I just have one type of fermion.
Yeah.
So it can only be itself.
But the map of the charges is not something which is a dynamical thing coming out of with the fermions. It's just really the what were labels in your Lagrangian, you're permuting them, and that's
yeah
part of the story.
So we get a simple answer. So this Q squared is what you looks like the ordinary anomaly, but now it's the Witten charge included in there. And then there's two new funny bits. There's a magnetic charge squared. This is the relative enhancement you'd naively expect. And then there's a non-CP violating FF, but because G is CP odd, that makes sense too. So the linear term in G has the CP even piece. And you can check that this is equal to the one loop beta function that Argyris and Douglas calculated from their theory, which is always true for, since the anomaly is a one loop thing, it always agrees with the beta function at one loop, since you're putting in a charge one here, basically. So that's, we'll check that off as calculation works. And this also tells you that this agrees with what just doing the perturbative calculation would have told you, right? This tells you that the if you wanted this anomaly to vanish, you'd need the sum of the charges squared to vanish for both electric and magnetic and the cross term. Okay, let's do a gauge anomaly. So imagine that we have some SUN gauge symmetry, and then there'll be an SUN squared U1 mixed anomaly. That's equivalent to having some anomalous term in the Lagrangian that has the non-abelian field strengths and a gauge parameter of the U1 appearing. So such a term should not appear, which is why we require that this coefficient zero, which we calculate from the anomaly, has to be add up to zero in a sensible theory. But here's where we needed the, even with fancy SL2Z techniques, we need to know the Sponsiger trick, because we need to know how the gauge parameter transforms under SL2Z. But since we knew what the gauge potentials were doing, we know how the gauge parameter transforms the same way. So again, it's the same trick. We write down the anomaly in the case where we just have an electric charge. We write it in terms of something that we know how it transforms simply. Omega was omega A plus I omega B. Then we transform back, plug in what C and D were, and we get the final expression. And not surprisingly, this is the usual anomaly cancellation condition, and then we get an extra one involving the magnetic charge. We'll do one more. I won't take you all the way through it, but if we can calculate the U1 cubed anomaly, then we have to do three transformations. So the expression is longer, but it follows the pattern we've seen before. It always involves the Witten effective charge. Even powers of magnetic coupling come with the CP odd combination, odd powers. This guy's also odd. And then this is even and odd again, and odd and even. So it's exactly what you'd expect. And so the summary for the U1 cubed anomaly cancellation conditions is the usual condition on the charges, but then all possible cubic combinations of electric and magnetic. And that's obviously what you would got just directly doing triangle diagrams with the two gauge fields. So that's the end of our warm-up calculation. Any questions? Okay, so I showed you here a bunch of things that vanish. Now I'm going to try to calculate something that doesn't vanish.
Just yep. So, previously you mentioned you start with ion with the Q and the G, and you do modular transformation to get to something with the Q. And is this always possible?
Given that Q and G can always be integers by Seiberg and Witten have this isogeny transformation. Usually, you can always choose Q to be an integer, and then quantization tells you that G has to be a half integer. But with another massage of redefining coupling constants, you can make them both integers, and then you can always do this. Because they'll always have a greatest common denominator. Okay, so let's calculate something that doesn't vanish. So here's where helicity amplitudes come in. So we saw that this thing has a simple transformation, and also its complex conjugate has a simple transformation. And it's these combinations of field strengths that are the helicity eigenstates. I guess I switched. This used to be called star F, not tilde F. Sorry, that's still the dual F. These are the helicity eigenstates. So if we want to use our fancy techniques, it will only work on helicity amplitudes, because those are the things that transform simply. Or I guess it would work in general, but it would be a lot more work. It will be very simple if we use helicity amplitudes. Since these guys transform this way, external polarization vectors will transform analogously. So Why is this going to work? So with anomalies, you guys didn't give me a hard time, even though there were 4 pi over e's appearing in various terms, because anomalies are exact at one loop, and presumably you forgave me that.
Yeah, that's what it was, yeah.
But now photon scattering is not exact at one loop, so how are we going to deal with 4 pi's over e's? And the claim is that it's all an illusion. Nothing up my sleeves. Okay, so we have this interaction. We can written like this. So effectively what we have is a complexified gauge field. So what we could ask is, what is the magnitude of the coupling to the complexified gauge field? So let's start with an arbitrary dion. Some dual description and go back to the ordinary description. So what, and we'll call this magnitude the effective strength of our complexified gauge field. So E dual is actually just equal to E times mod C tau plus D. And this is that transformation of that mixes up electric and magnetic currents. This is the electric, this is the magnetic, and also tau prime transforms, or tau transforms under SL2Z. So this is just writing out what SL2Z transformation tells us. And then let's see how it get simple. Look, there's a mod C tau plus D. So if we combine this, put this, multiply this by C tau plus D over C tau plus D, so everything is over C tau plus D, then this will cancel the C tau plus D in the bottom. And then we'll have AQ minus BQ times C tau plus D, but look at AQ C tau minus CQ A tau goes away. And there's a minus BG D and a plus BDG. So the only things that are left are AD minus BC times Q plus G tau. But SL2Z told us this always has to be one. So this is the magnitude of the complexified gauge field coupling in the other basis, as we expect. So this is another invariant under SL2Z. The strength of the local coupling to the complex gauge field is invariant, the magnitude.
Was this basically kind of down to the criterion that you, when you map it to the place where there's no magnetic monopole and everything's just a charge, that has to be perturbative?
Well, if I'm assuming that I have one basis, it's obviously perturbative. And then what it's showing is that in any other basis.
But that's if you had monopoles and charges, then the problem would have been that in the electric wave or the magnetic wave looking at it, it looks like you're carrying around a particle that's coming like one over.
Yeah, if you had degenerate mutually non-local charges,
then
it would be presumably strongly coupled, and then you wouldn't be able to do it in any basis.
So you're living off the fact that you have a symmetry that allows you to write it where you don't have the one that's going like one over E, because there's no magnetic monopoles, and there it was perturbative, and then you map it back using the symmetry.
So we can do this calculation. So someone has calculated these box diagrams. They're actually really nasty if you ever tried to do it yourself. But here's the answer for the non-vanishing amplitudes. There's some funny 11 over 45. Otherwise.
By the way, this all works if you have a monopole that's fundamental. What if it's like a top monopole where there is the issue of the size?
I'll get there.
Oh, okay.
Be patient. So here's what we get just from electron in the loop. Now we can calculate with a dyon in the loop. We can do it two ways. We can either just do the SL2Z transformation and then go back to canonical normalization. Notice these are canonically normalized because the couplings are appearing here. These get canonically normalized by the dual coupling. But you can see that the amplitudes are not equal. The easiest place to see that is here. This amplitude is complex, and this amplitude is real. So definitely not equal. But the SL2Z transformation and the direct Zwanziger calculation give exactly the same answers. So that's a cross-check there. Now, does this satisfy duality? You might think not, because the amplitudes don't agree. But if you look at the squares of the amplitudes by a magic identity, this squared is that squared, and by the definition of E dual, this is equal to that under the transformation. So the squares of amplitudes for each helicity channel match. And that's what duality really requires. It doesn't require that amplitudes have to be equal, but observables have to be equal. So what we've done is taken classical, so we knew that there was this duality classically. Now we've seen that it still works at one loop. Now we want to.
So you require more than that each individual amplitude has the same square. You need some derivative phases to do.
At one loop, there's only one term, but when we go to higher orders, there'll be yes, yes.
And that works.
Well, we're going to check. Let's check. So let's go to higher orders. What's going to happen? We'll have extra internal lines, but we'll still have a fixed number of legs. each propagator will have epsilon star epsilon. And as we saw, that transforms by this. So it doesn't actually introduce a new phase. And plus helicities and minus helicities have slightly different phase properties. So what you can see is that for the holomorphically normalized amplitudes, they all transform as what are called modular forms in this business. So you'll get c tau plus d to the number of internal lines plus the number of negative helicity legs, and c tau star plus d to internal lines plus positive helicity legs. But as we saw, this times that is real. So the number of internal lines doesn't contribute to the phases. The phases are all determined by the external legs. So every term in the series gets the same phase. So it should work order by order in perturbation theory. And also, what you can check that the Zwanziger propagator, given that you know how A and B transform for the Zwanziger Lagrangian, you also verify this transformation.
So I didn't get that. So the thing that is I dependent you're saying is real, but it's not one, right? So
yeah, because these are holomorphically normalized amplitudes. When we go to canonically normalized amplitudes, the same thing comes in that the once we put in the gauge couplings, take it out of the gauge kinetic term and put it into the couplings.
And for every line it'll do that.
So, yeah, okay. Transforms to the correct coupling. So it works order by order in perturbation theory and our effective theory. Does it work forever? It shouldn't work forever. So the crucial thing was that everything always depended on the Witten charge. But this piece of the Witten charge, this is something that you, this is valid at low energies, so soft photons probing it. This part of the charge, the theta piece, comes from fermion zero modes around the monopole. And there's no simple reason why that piece is going to have a, it shouldn't have a constant form factor. It should have some non-trivial form factor. Once the momentum of the photon is probing the mass scale of the particles that are the zero modes. So once you get to high enough energies, it should break down in general. It would be nice to understand why in n equals 4 it doesn't break down. So that's another homework exercise for you guys. But in general, electric and magnetic form factors should be different at short distances. So we don't expect it to work forever, only in some low energy effective theory. Okay. Are we almost done? What's the time?
No.
15? I only got 5 minutes here.
So, just before you go, so there was at some point an interest of calculating light by light diagram with a dime inside attached to an electron with this dime kind of great CP, as you said.
But is there a hierarchy between the masses of the?
Yes, yes. You kind of integrate out the diamond, you get this four-photon scattering amplitude. But unfortunately, when you attach the three legs of a photon and integrate over those, the momentum wants to see that the scale of the mass of the diamond. So it's actually almost three big calculations. But at the end, the end result is that at some point the electron should have a medium.
Okay.
You're going to have a strong coupling in that way, so you're going to try and do it perfectly.
What's that?
Either your ion has some strong magnetic charge, you have a non-terminal coupling. How are you going to try
They probably didn't know what he did, right?
No, no, but you can't simultaneously make them both weak to quantums.
Yeah, but why can't he just do his trick where he maps it to the point where there's no magnetic charge at all?
No, because then you have to map the charge to the electron.
Well,
if you map...
In the end, he gets an amplitude that one of the pieces would probably connect F dual to 3Fs, right?
It might be easier just to do, but I think you've still got a non-conservative coupling going on, however you do it, right?
Well, that's Astro claim is you don't, right?
No, if you only have one species,
if
you have to worry about both of them simultaneously. That's the point of this calculation.
You should map the other guy. But
you can't map them both to an electron.
Right. If you could separate them out, you could do the calculation with one thing and then.
They're separated out by the virtue of one being fairly maybe you have to go through the sum of loops, that's what you're saying. Right? But the scaling of the mass will be fixed with the Hegel mass. Anyway.
Okay. So now that you've mastered everything about calculating with electric and magnetic charges,
go back one slide. So you had an argument about why there's only no energy, and I don't think I got the argument. So let's say this is just you through the angle scores. You have this exact statement that there's this duality.
That's what people claim.
Yeah, so your claim is that that's false.
My claim is that I would like to see why the form factors of a monopole and a charge are the same at all energies. So the form factor is constant at low energies, but then eventually the monopole has zero modes around it, and the W plus gauge boson, as far as I know, doesn't have zero modes around it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be in the multiplet that it's in.
So you're always going to define your calculation by going to this basis where there are no magnetic charges, doing the calculation there perturbatively, then going back. So how can you ever fail to have it? Almost by definition, you're building the symmetry.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is there's a higher dimension operator that we did not include in our Zwanziger Lagrangian. And that higher dimension operator generically breaks SL2Z because it distinguishes form factors of monopoles and charges.
But if your algorithm for calculating the coefficient of that operator is SL2Z, you're just going to say you're just going to rise with zero coefficient because you're doing an SL2Z.
Well, but in my effective theory, my calculation had just a point coupling.
Yeah.
I have a form factor in there. So if I put different form factors in the electric and magnetic couplings, then I won't have SL2Z invariants.
The question is in n equals 4, the thing is this high dimension operator is zero.
Somehow. Yeah.
You can feel about that. And the question is why is that the case?
Well, so at some level, they've given you the ultraviolet complete, right? It's just n equals 4 all the way up. So what's wrong with their statement that's just wait, what that is, that does have the SL2Z symmetry. So now if I integrate step down, I'm going to not ruin the symmetry.
Well, if I go to the UV, so I'm probing, have photons that have a momentum much higher than the W plus mass, then I should see that there's a charge distribution around the monopole. Charge distribution is controlled by, you solve for the Gugino zero mode around that monopole. And the W does not have a charge distribution like that around it.
So I can't say the physics argument that shows why it's true might not be obvious, but it sounds like whatever your argument is, it's going to build in the symmetry, so it's hard to see how you could fail. You're going to put yourself for perturbative, where that means I go to the place where there's no magnetic charges and I do the calculation there.
Well, in n equals 4, the claim is that it has duality at all scales. I mean, there's no break. So I should be able to probe a monopole with an arbitrarily high energy photon and measure its form factor.
Okay.
And it has some structure due to zero modes, which the W boson does not. And so you'd naively expect that the form factors are different because there's very different physics going on.
But But then it's also true that you would have naturally thought that in the basis where you do have negative charges, the power counting is weird too, because you've got things that are like 1 over E and things are going like E. But the way you resolved that at the end of the day was you relied on the symmetry to say, I had a way of thinking about it, but there is no magnetic charge. So although in that original set of variables, I can see it could be a complicated argument, but it seems like the answer has to be the one that's SL2Z for me.
Well, but I assume there were no form factors in my couplings in the whole story.
But that's because of the full theory didn't give you one. So
yeah.
This would be saying you're not going to generate one as you integrate stuff. It sounds like that's what the argument would be, that you're integrating, as you integrate stuff out, it won't generate for you those operators, if it's true that they're SL2Z non-invariant.
But if I probe it with a high enough energy photon, I can measure whether the form factor is there.
Yeah.
And because there's this extra charge distribution around the monopole,
but that's a semi-classical argument. Maybe it's failing because there's a whole bunch of one over E factors that you have to track, a bunch of graphs you don't really think about because you have the magnetic charges in that basis, which wouldn't have been there if you go over to the basis where the magnetic charges aren't there.
Well, I'm not saying it can't work. I'm saying it's not obvious that it does work. And it would be nice if someone who understands why they think n equals 4 has an exact SL2Z.
So it's not a given that it doesn't, but you're saying you'd like to see.
Certainly for n equals 2, it should break down. Because the SL2Z of n equals 2 Cyber-Guitton was only claimed to be a low energy approximation anyway. So we're going to quickly look at Cyber-Guitton, and it's all going to be transparent now that we've done these calculations. That's the claim. So remind you, we had n equals 2 supersymmetry. We break SE2 to U1 by the VEV of the scalar adjoint. That scalar adjoint has a moduli space parameterized by a complex parameter U. That's this plane. The low energy effective theory is completely determined by these elliptic curves, which are toruses. From those toruses, we calculate these functions by doing integrals around the torus that depend on the intrinsic scale of SU2 and this parameter of the VEV, and these are some hypergeometric functions. From those things, we can calculate the exact mass of the monopole anywhere on the moduli space, and we can calculate the low energy U1 coupling by taking derivatives. So that's the remarkable answers they found. Now let's just go to this place. So when U is close to lambda squared, that's where the monopole vanishes. So I'm just Taylor expanding their formula for the mass around this point where the monopole becomes light. And I can also calculate the low energy coupling. And I can Taylor expand in m over lambda, since m is getting small. And I get a very simple formula for the coupling. And we see that as m goes to 0, as u approaches lambda squared, e diverges. So that's what this picture was telling us. So this is a description of a almost massless monopole in theory where the electric coupling is getting very large. Now we can go to an SL2Z dual description. We map the monopole to an electron, and tau goes to minus 1 over tau, which means alpha dual is minus I tau, since alpha dual is up top now. So minus I tau means that alpha dual is this thing. And you recognize that this is just the perturbative running of an electron. As the electron mass goes to 0, the gauge coupling runs to 0. So in the dual description, there's nothing mysterious in the low energy theory. You have a theory with an electron. If we map it back to the original description where the electron is a monopole, there's a strong electric coupling there, but that monopole couples with 1 over that coupling, which again is this perturbative coupling. So the low energy effective theory is just a perturbative U1 theory. And we could calculate it if we could easily calculate it if we went to the description where it's an electron, and everything would make sense. The final thing that you might be confused about is that in the electric description, the coupling is infrared free. But in the magnetic, where it's a monopole, the coupling is growing in the infrared. And why does the beta function flip sign when we go back and forth? That seems to be some complicated non-perturbative thing, surely. So we can just calculate two-point function amplitudes. We know how they transform, and in this case, D is 0 and C is 1. And if we go back to, so we just get a phase if we go back to canonical normalization, and that phase is minus 1, since we knew it. If we take theta to 0 for simplicity, the phase is just minus 1 from here. So that's the SL2Z phase that we pick up in the amplitudes. So that is what flips the sign of the beta function, even though both theories are perturbative. So it's only mysterious if we try to use Dirac's Lagrangian, where there's a non-local coupling and we don't even know how to calculate anything. But if we wrote it in Zwanziger's Lagrangian, it would be perturbative in either description, since we have local couplings. And the strength of the local coupling is invariant.
And all the polarization vectors don't depend on this n variable.
Right. Just they transform by c tau plus d.
Is there a proof that in this, when you do the higher order thing, you were counting the modular stuff, but is there a proof that the n dependence in the, because the propagator must depend on n, right?
Yeah. So no, that's a leap of faith, that the actual independence disappears in observables, like it should.
Yeah.
So it does at one loop.
Can you make an argument along the lines of that the independence is all engage-dependent things? Is it engage-dependent things are not independent?
That's sort of the argument that Schwartz and Senn make. So if we believe Schwartz and Senn's thing is actually invariant properly, then Zwanziger should also be, since theirs is a special case of his. But I have not seen any two-loop calculations done in that formalism, because it is a little ugly. All right, so that gets us to the conclusion. So anomalies for monopoles and dions are easily calculated because they're one-loop exact, and we can write down a local Lagrangian for such things. And I claimed that every low-energy effective U1 theory should enjoy an SL2Z duality. Certainly in the case where you have arranged the spectrum so that you know that it's weakly coupled, we saw that there's a weak duality. And I'd expect that there's also a strong duality, not that it does you any good. And I already said this. SL2Z does not exchange strong and weak. So it's not mysterious like cyborg duality. It's actually simple like electromagnetic duality. Okay, thanks.
There's a sense in which it is interesting. You could have chosen to describe things in terms of magnetic couplings, which are, right? So there's a set of variables for which it's a strongly coupled thing, which are not one of your
Then it would have been mapped to another strongly coupled thing.
Yeah, but it's like, so there's an electric set of variables where it's, say, weakly coupled, and a magnetic set of variables are strong coupled, and they map to each other. But it doesn't mean that there is an absence of a strongly coupled language of when people say it changes strongly weak, what they mean is that electric and magnetic are being interchanged, and the coupling is going to one over itself, and so that there is a strong language that you could think of as being mapped to the weakly coupled. It's not contradicting what you said.
Okay. What I'm claiming is that if you actually calculated amplitudes, if they're perturbative in one description, then they're perturbative in any other SL2Z transform description.
But that's because you define them to be, the way you calculate them is you go to the SL2Z and then set it correctly. You get rid of the magnetic charge by doing the transformation, calculating it there and going back.
So. Well, no, I could have directly calculated in the Dion description with Vonziger.
So that's the thing that, that's the thing that I guess I'm getting from your talk is that it wasn't hard to make down this theory of the Dions. It was stupid easy, you're saying. It's just fermions. So when you say that you have these two ways of calculating it, when you calculate it when they're honest to God Dions, was there an issue that you had to keep track of couplings that were going like 1 over E anyway?
There was.
If you think about it right, it never is true that you have to sum a bunch of graphs here. It's always true that there's a small thing controlling the expansion, as I understand.
So, oops. Here, it looks like this thing relative to that, depending on what alpha dual was. Here, if we take alpha to be small, then alpha dual should be big. So one of these should be big, it looks like. But when we actually put in the relations that we used, this combination of things, it's just that combination. So if this was small,
Q prime is the basis where there's no magnetic charge.
Q prime is just an electric charge, and then this is the Witten charge and the magnetic charge.
The reason that the last term has no G's in it is that was a place where there was no G prime.
Yeah, this is when we mapped it to the just purely electric charge.
So because I don't see any, so then I don't see that there's a check there. Right? The way I understand it is that you're defining what the theory means in the place where you have these 1 over E's by the statement that you can map it to a place using the symmetry to a place where there was no magnetic charge, and then the symmetry plus the absence of magnetic charge is what controls everything. And you don't have a calculation to compare that to.
So, I mean, there's two calculations you can do. You can just directly take Zwanziger's Lagrangian and calculate these graphs.
So you're saying that's the thing you're comparing to, is that it needn't have worked, but it does.
Yeah. Or you can take the SL2Z transformation of these amplitudes and get the same answer either way.
Now, does that work in general? Is it because the thing the operator you're calculating essentially is SL2Z invariant? Is that why it works? Or is it something that you have to check process by process? Because your amplitudes in the end.
I think it's really because the SL2Z acting on this Vonziger Lagrangian is just a field redefinition.
Yeah.
Because you explicitly have electric and magnetic gauge potentials. It's just a field redefinition in his Lagrangian. In the Dirac Lagrangian, it's some mysterious non-local thing.
So if you calculate some off-shell thing, it might not have been invariant. It might not have been the same thing. But once you get the physical things that don't care about redefinition, it's
another question kind of related. So you're looking at the situation where you have one fermion with some, let's say, a single dion fermion. In that case, you can always map it to some of the electric charge, and then you open up a cascade or whatever, with the top result, and you have to work harder from the bottom. But suppose you have multiple fermions with different QG combinations. So do the wheels fall off the wagon in that case?
Generically, it's just strongly coupled, and you need to do a lattice simulation. My student is calculating a case where it's mutually non-local, but only slightly mutually non-local. So say you have a dion that has electric charge Q and magnetic charge N, and N is large, and another one that has electric charge Q and magnetic charge N plus a half, or N plus one, depending on your misogyny. Let's say N plus one. So when N is large, those are almost pointing in the same direction. So in the large N limit, they become local. So you can expand in 1 over N and do a calculation where they're a mutually non-local calculation.
Same way.
Well, in this case, we want to do the electron monopole scattering, which is the... This doesn't tell you how to do that.
less questions.
So if you try to construct a monopole and then try and get the low-energy effective theory starting from the UV theory, is there some sort of logic by which you end up with the Swansky Lagrangian or something like that? Or?
Well, I guess this procedure for integrating in, so you can always add new fields, new auxiliary fields,
yeah.
And that's Zwanziger essentially has a redundant auxiliary field built in. But to actually do it, I don't know. I don't know how to do it off the top of my head. No.
So that difference between the holistic amplitude is only from is only from the phase of the field that we need.
Yeah.
Okay. Then the correlation function is still the same.
Well, the magnitudes are the same. The phases are different.
Yeah, but I mean the amplitude can be seen as the like a 4-point correlation function, and so I mean because this, the difference. So the difference is only due to so there's an additional phase in the all plus amplitude. So the difference is only by the phase. So that phase from the field we can measure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I mean is that even the amplitude is different, but the correlation function is still the same, because in that case the amplitude is something like you calculate the correlation function and then divide it by the something like the normalization of the property or something like that. Basically it's not how you normalize the field.
That wouldn't remove the phases, right?
Yeah.
That's a real rescaling, if I'm understanding. That's like going to canonical normalization, sort of.
So can you show me so in one slide you show the transformation of the helicity field in this slide. So you see when you do the transformation, you have something like a phase between this helicity and
yeah,
states.
So they get different phases, right?
Yeah, and then they get different phases, and the only difference is in the amplitude. It's for the all plus or all minus, right?
Right, because if you have equal number of plus and minus, then the phases
and that's
cancel.
So the only difference is from here. So it's not very surprised that the amplitude is different by phase.
Well, yeah, if duality was going to work, the only way the amplitudes could be different was by a phase, otherwise it wouldn't be a duality.
So I have one last question, but I think we should let people go first.
Yeah. Let's thank the speaker again.